Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this podcast, we highlight people's stories. We celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. Welcome to episode 16 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Monday, September 25th, 2017. Hello, and thank you for listening. One of the things I try to do with the show is to answer your questions. A question I receive a lot from white Americans working in the climate movement is, how can we encourage diversity in our group? How can we connect with people of color? They tell me we can't seem to get people of color interested in our local chapter. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said, "It is appalling that the most segregated hour of Christian America is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Perhaps the next most segregated hour may be when people concerned about environmental issues meet." The international climate movement looks very diverse compared to what we see in many climate groups in America. The reality is there are lots of people of color in the USA concerned about the effects of climate change and our rapidly changing planet. So, are there two parallel climate movements in the USA? And if so, what are the differences? How are people defining the word environment differently? What do people of color concerned about climate change and environmental impacts to their communities want white climate advocates to know? What roles do climate organizations with mostly white members play in environmental justice work? Today, we take on a big story. Bigger than any single extreme weather event, we explore the topics of environmental justice and climate justice. We look at how injustice in society, particularly in the USA, deepens suffering during a time of climate change. My guest will reveal how pollution and extreme weather in the USA have already harmed people of color, indigenous people, and people living in poverty. We will see how environmental justice affects people in the countryside as well as in cities. We will also hear about creative, strategic, and effective steps community members have taken to make the world a better and more just place. We begin in Harlem, in northern New York City. Meet Peggy Shepherd. The co-founder and executive director of We Act for Environmental Justice, Peggy has been engaged in social justice work and environmental protection for over 30 years. What began as a local action to protect citizens in Harlem from pollution turned into a national effort to empower and organize low-income people and people of color to build healthy communities for all. Peggy did not set out to start an organization and a movement. This journey began when she won an election as a local district leader in Harlem.
Which is like a ward leader, maybe out in the West. It's an elected position, but non-paid, of course. You're a major volunteer.
This was the late 1980s. A new sewage power plant had been proposed for her district. What initially seemed like a source of sorely needed jobs for residents turned into one of the nation's earliest successful environmental justice actions.
So we thought the issue was jobs, getting people hired at the plant. But then the plant began operating, and we realized that it was a major public nuisance. It had odors, and we were able to also monitor the emissions and realize that the emissions were at a higher than regulated level. So we began an eight-year organizing campaign to hold the city accountable. To make a long story short, we had 100 people coming out along Riverside Drive every month for really 8 years. Everyone got really educated on the issue and on air quality impacts as well. We ended up suing the city and getting $1 million settlement of our lawsuit, from which we were able to get an amount to start the organization as a paid group. We were all volunteer. It also committed $55 million to fix what was a brand new plant. And we were able to hire an engineer to oversee the fact that it was fixed, you know, in accordance with the protocol that was established. So that was our first big campaign. But of course, once you see an issue in a community, you begin to really look around and see others. And so we also began to realize that we host over one-third of the city's diesel bus fleet. And New York City has the largest bus fleet in the country. Those buses are housed uptown, often in depots that were crowded, so the buses were on the streets, outside of people's homes, outside of schools, idling. And of course, you know, idling of the emissions was very negative to public health. At the same time, we began to understand that we had all these air quality issues. So we reached out to the Columbia School of Public Health so that we could find some researchers who might help us monitor and better understand the health effects of air quality exposures. We did that, and 17 years later, we're here today with still a strong partnership with the two Columbia Research Centers that have turned out incredible research looking at air toxins' impact on the health of children and mothers in this community, looking at the exposure of children to chemicals in their products, in their toys, looking at the impact of household pesticide use on respiratory health. Our research partnerships have been crucial in forming the underpinning of our policy campaigns to get the city to invest in cleaner buses, which they have done, and now every single bus in New York City is a cleaner bus, it's a hybrid. We have been able to pass legislation at the state legislature banning flame retardants and certain chemicals in children's products. So we've been able to translate that research into policy that really works for people.
PEGI and WEAC have been highly successful. So how do they engage local residents?
And so we do that through organizing, through outreach of information. We do that through training. You know, once you identify leaders, organize people to let them know about impact on them of the issue, then you've got to put them in a program that helps them share their knowledge of what's going on in the community or in their block or in their home. And we are sharing knowledge on what the impacts could be and how they can address them. And so organizing them again to unify their voices to elected officials, to City Hall, and to Congress.
In addition to the work they do in Harlem, WEACT has recently opened an office in Washington, D.C. PEGI explains that having the office in the U.S. Capitol
allows us to develop our grassroots campaigns in Harlem and understand the policies that need to change so that those impacts are not happening in Harlem and the Harlems of the world. But the issues of environmental justice are very critical in rural communities as well. For instance, we coordinate an environmental justice leadership forum on climate change. So it's basically a coalition of 40 groups around the country in 19 states working on a whole variety of issues. Some are in rural communities in South Carolina or Mississippi, or in Ohio or West Virginia. We have Appalachian groups that are part of that forum as well, because we realize that the impacts are not only on communities of color, but on the lowest income communities as well. We know that in rural communities, for instance, we may not work on that issue, but we're advocates for the issue because we understand the different ways that these issues impact Indian country. Indian country is right there with so many of our American rural communities, and they have similar issues of extraction, of fracking, of mining. And what are those impacts on Native Americans or rural Americans living in poor communities? We know those are very serious impacts. Many folks out in the Arizona and Nevada areas were there when nuclear testing was done, and to the disgrace of this country, we did that testing in rural areas where there were native populations or, you know, other residents who were impacted. And so we've seen a large amount of cancers in the Navajo and other Indian tribes who were out in the West in the nuclear testing age. We also have seen the issues of contaminated water infrastructure in Flint, Michigan. But we've got contaminated well water throughout rural America, where groundwater has been contaminated by mining or other kinds of extraction. And again, and fracking as well, that has contaminated the well water, which many rural communities depend upon.
I asked Peggy, how do you define the word environment?
Yeah, you know, the environmental justice movement some years ago came up with a phrase that I hear almost everywhere now, even from government. And the environment is where we live, work, play, and go to school. It is all of those natural environment. It's our built environment. It's our social environment. And those interactions are what either lead to our well-being or to our negative mental and health issues as well.
And what about climate justice? What is the connection between environmental justice and climate change?
Yeah, you know, climate justice is not just a cool phrase for climate change. Climate justice really is focusing on the impacts of climate on the most vulnerable populations and communities in this country. So the communities that are at waterfronts, at ocean fronts, those are the most vulnerable. And within those communities, the lowest income folks are even more vulnerable. As we saw in New Orleans post-Katrina, the poorest people did not have a credit card to go stay at a hotel. They did not have a car to escape to another state or another city. They were the ones who were being evacuated from rooftops and sitting in a stadium for nights and nights, weeks and weeks. Those voices were not heard in the planning. So one thing that REACT does is engage residents in the planning. Because if you had had low-income voices in New Orleans planning, they would have known that these people can't go to a hotel. They would have known maybe we need to have transit or buses or vans because people don't have cars to relocate. So there would have been different options. For instance, a city like New York City, where most people don't drive, you know, you would need to take that into account if you were planning evacuations. And so all of those elements of a city that sometimes only those who live in those neighborhoods understand, those voices need to be heard in planning for climate. So climate justice is really about understanding and addressing the impacts that are going to happen to the most vulnerable. Heat impacts will happen every year and they will get more severe. Sea level rises will be less often, but the sea level is continuously rising. And if you're at the waterfront, like Alaska Natives, many Alaska Natives are already having to evacuate from the waterfront, which changes their whole lifestyle, their historic legacy to the land and to sustainable fishing. For sustainable fishing and eating, they need to have quality waterfronts and water that is not contaminated.
With climate change comes extreme weather. We have seen the devastation brought about by the recent hurricanes. While the floods from Hurricane Harvey covered Houston and the news cycle, a story in California got buried. There was a record heat wave that hit San Francisco and the Bay Area. Usually temperate, San Francisco broke a record on September 1st. The temperature reached 41 degrees Celsius, or 106 degrees Fahrenheit. That is rare for the Bay Area and devastating. New York City, on the other hand, has had a history of heat waves. With climate change, it's only getting worse. I asked Peggy, what about extreme heat in New York City?
We just had a research partnership with CUNY Grad Center, two other, a nonprofit and a city agency, to look at heat in Harlem. And so we were able to get 30 of our members to allow us to put temperature sensors in their apartments during last summer. And so those sensors were able to tell us about the temperatures in those apartments and something about humidity. And what we found was that because of the built environment in New York City, buildings hold in a lot of heat. So, you know, you might have a 90 degree daytime temperature, and at night it could go down to the 60s, say. But in certain buildings, it is not going down to 60. That heat is continuing to burn within that building, if you may. And so the relief that you might get outdoors at night, you're not getting indoors. And because that heat is stored, the heat could actually be hotter indoors than it is outside. And so what are people doing? The city has cooling centers that nobody goes to, that nobody can find, that may have given you the wrong address on a website. And people don't want to leave the security and perhaps the comfort of their home to go to some strange place, maybe 10 blocks away, where it could be empty, there could be no water or refreshments or television or anything to do. So the cooling centers haven't quite been the answer. The members who have the sensors in their homes, who were part of the study, felt that maybe the sensors could be linked up to the 311 city emergency system, which I thought was an interesting idea. The city already is like, saying, yikes, no, no, no. because I think they realized they would be getting thousands of calls. We haven't come up with the solution yet, but we are exploring options, and we continue to work with our members and with our partners to ramp up and have a more robust study.
During the recent San Francisco heat wave, six elderly people died of heat stroke. Reports state that none of them had air conditioning. In the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, six more seniors died in a Florida nursing home. They perished in rooms without air conditioning because of power outages. An inquiry has been launched to investigate if there was also neglect. Creating plans to protect the most vulnerable during extreme heat events is a climate justice issue. Back in the late 1980s, I attended City College in Harlem, New York. I lived on West 146th Street and remember seeing the monthly demonstrations on Riverside Drive organized by We Act for Environmental Justice. They stood to draw attention to problems the new sewage plant created for the community. They demanded action. It was my very first exposure to an environmental group, but I didn't get involved. I kept busy with my studies and my church. Years later, when I began focusing my work on climate change, I noticed that mainstream environmental organizations in the USA seem to mostly have white members and leaders. Over the past 4 years, I've sat in sessions where passionate white climate advocates want to know how to promote diversity and encourage people of color to join their groups. As we wrapped up the interview, I asked Peggy about this.
I'd like to dispel the idea that people of color or low income are not interested in these issues. I think if you really look at the polls, it shows that people of color are at a higher rate of appreciation for the environment than other folks. And I would just say that even in a city like New York, you mentioned you went to City College. Well, you might have thought that the people living around City College and the brownstones would be the people coming out on environmental issues, right? They're more affluent and blah, blah, blah. But it's people in public housing. It's people who, yes, may be underemployed, may have a tougher road to go, but they are the ones receiving the worst impacts, and they know it. And when you can bring that to their attention and provide some leadership and support for their voices, they will come out and they will talk about those issues because they are looking to get them addressed. And when they understand that you have a concern and a care they come out and they cooperate, they collaborate, and they make their voices heard, and they get empowered to take control in other aspects of their lives and their communities.
My next guest lives in Tampa, Florida. While she describes herself as a policy wonk who researches transportation issues, she is also very passionate about the effects of climate change and about climate justice. Meet Dr. Beverly G. Ward. Born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama, Beverly was aware of the American Civil Rights Movement from a young age.
May of 1963, a famous march took place. It's called the Children's Crusade. And this is when the black public schools in Birmingham were pretty much empty. Public schools, high schools, colleges. My mother and my teachers would not let me go. I was seven, and sort of radicalized me, I would say, because it was like, I want to go march.
Beverly has a thirst for knowledge. For her undergraduate work, she studied psychology, film, and drama. She continued her studies and has a PhD in applied anthropology and public administration. At the University of South Florida, she has taught a variety of classes, including community sustainability and geographic information systems. And through her consulting company, Beverly conducts research and provides technical assistance to communities, local, state, and federal agencies. She is always looking at transportation systems. Who has access? Who doesn't? I met her at a Southeast regional gathering of Quakers where she serves as the field director for EarthCare. I asked Beverly about Florida and about climate change.
I'll give you two examples. One is sunny day flooding. When there's high tides, the seawater will come in through the storm system into streets, neighborhood streets, and flood in the middle of the day. It tends to be low-income communities that are more affected than others. The response varies among cities. One city mayor decided that he was going to raise the street level, and once you get up to a certain height, the insurance company said, oh, you now have a basement. We don't insure basements in Florida. So that's not a real solution. On the West Coast, the Gulf Coast where I live, it's been documented already that the water in Tampa Bay has risen 8 inches within the last decade. The person who looked at it, Kent Bailey, the president of the Tampa Bay Sierra Club, didn't believe the numbers himself. So he had someone at USF Marine Sciences look at it, and they said, yes. And he had somebody else look at it, and he said, yes, this is true. Yeah, it's happening. We're having flooding problems because the water table's so high. The Floridan aquifer is one of the most productive in the world, but is being threatened by pollution from fertilizer, from golf courses, from big sugar, phosphate mining, and of course now the Sable Trail and Southeast Transmission Pipeline, which is fracked natural gas, coming to Florida, and we're quite sure it's not going to be used in Florida. Water is a big issue in Florida, of course. We know we're going to lose the coastline. How do we make sensible decisions, such as not adding more lanes to the interstate, especially toll lane facilities?
Toll roads limit who gets to use these highways. With Hurricane Irma, Florida Governor Rick Scott suspended tolls on roads to aid in the evacuation efforts. Even so, the task of moving so many Floridians north led to gas shortages and epic traffic jams. So, as we see bigger storms, is our response getting better? Since Hurricane Katrina struck in August 2005 and Hurricane Rita a month later, what have we learned?
After Katrina, there was this national response framework that was handed down. And then when Hurricane Rita hit, they tried to evacuate, and the interstate turned into a parking lot. People ran out of gas. The Army came in to refill the gas tanks, and the nozzles wouldn't fit on the private automobiles. There were people who had autism or other conditions that they could not sit in a car for 12 hours on an interstate. If work had been done with that community, those parents, those people who are affected by the condition could have said, no, I can't do that. So maybe I need a shelter in place, or here's where I'd like to shelter.
When a big storm like Irma hits, the media and public watching from a distance has a habit of judging people who do not evacuate. Beverly explains that evacuation for some is not so easy.
10% of the households in the state of Florida are mobile homes. The counties require that when there's a tropical storm, they evacuate. And not everybody's able to evacuate. You talk about environmental justice, I'm talking like persons with disabilities, I'm talking low income, I'm talking ethnic and racial minorities, persons who live in zero vehicle households. If you don't have a car, how do you evacuate? If you do have a car, how old is the car? You know, these are the people who are most vulnerable, and these are social vulnerabilities.
Beverly echoes something Peggy Shepherd insists is essential in climate justice work and pre-disaster planning.
It has to be bringing people to the table that are impacted. Nothing about us without us. You know, getting everybody to the table to address this.
Beverly is a visionary person. When I asked her how she defines the word environment, she jumped ahead into the future with a spaceship analogy. She is working on the 1,000-year planning model.
40 generations from now, if humans are here, what's our vision? You know, what do we need to do to keep the spaceship in shape? How are we going to keep the air clean? How are we going to keep the water system clean? The food supply, what structures, what will last, what's not a good decision? How will these decisions be made? Do we have the right crew leaders in place? Do we have the right system in place for managing the spaceship? How do we get there? How do we get to the 1,000-year place? What do we need to get there, and how do we start that now?
There is much more to learn about environmental justice and how each community takes different approaches. I am grateful to our guest today for giving us helpful overviews and examples. If you want to dig deeper, I have a list of links to resources in our show notes. You can find these on the Citizens Climate Radio episode 16 page. How do you get there? Easy. Just go to citizensclimatelobby.org, then scroll all the way to the bottom left. Under media, you will see Citizens Climate Radio. Click that link and you will find all the episode pages. In addition to articles, I have links to other podcasts, including Our Warm Regards. They just did an excellent show about environmental justice. Also, have a listen to episode 6 of our show and hear Dr. Natasha Desjanet talk about health risks and climate change. She explains how extreme weather events affect communities of color, seniors, and people with disabilities. And please share your resources with me and share your thoughts. My email is radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. We have come to the end of the show. There is no time this episode for the art house or the puzzler question. Next month, I promise I will share your answers to our puzzler question, which was about ugly windmills. See the show notes to episode 15 for the question and how you can send in your answer. Citizens Climate Radio is written and produced by me, Peter Santoscano. Technical support from Ricky Bradley. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. Special thanks to Peggy Shepherd, Dr. Beverly G. Ward, and Glenn Retief. All of the music we use on the show is licensed. Be sure to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. Look for the Citizens Climate Lobby feed wherever you listen to podcasts. This includes iTunes, Podbean, TuneIn, Google Play, and Stitcher Radio. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Join the discussion at our Facebook group page, facebook.com/groups/citizensclimateradio. If you tweet, follow us on Twitter, @CitizensCRadio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, @CitizensCRadio. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guest. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.